The realities of a pandemic, making sure kids are attending school from home, climbing domestic violence rates, and surviving the economic shutdown. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Kids are learning from home, and that's added a series of challenges like, how do you take accurate attendance? We'll hear about how Miami-Dade schools are trying to make sure students are taking their online courses. Also, staying at home can actually be dangerous for those who are dealing with domestic violence. Advocacy groups are getting a lot more calls for help. And Miami Beach Mayor Dan Gelber joins us to discuss the question of reopening the economy. Finally, we'll meet WLRN's new Palm Beach County reporter, Wilkin Brutus.
I tend to identify as Haitian American because I'm literally sandwiched between cultures and value systems.
All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, parents, be ready for the long haul. Governor Ron DeSantis announced on Saturday that schools across the state of Florida will stay remote. For Miami-Dade County, which is one of the largest school districts in the country, the success of remote teaching has been mixed. Overall, the school district is now seeing more than 91% of students logging on. But attendance rates are much lower at some schools, where a lot of students come from low-income and immigrant families. I spoke with WLRN reporter Jessica Bakeman and found out more about what the school district is doing to get kids connected.
A lot of schools in the district do have attendance rates in the high 90s, but we did find that for the first week, the district was taking attendance for online learning. So that was the week of April 6th. There were 40 schools where a quarter or more of students were absent at least one day, and 8 schools that had less than a 75% attendance rate that whole week. Those numbers have already started to improve, but many of the schools with the lowest numbers serve a lot of students in poverty. So first of all, we know that devices and connectivity are an issue, and that's something the school district was working on really quickly at the beginning. The district says that 99% of students have connected at some point, so they believe that they do have the ability to connect. And every day for the last couple of weeks, the district has been setting up hundreds of appointments to hand off devices, or if it's connectivity is the problem, a smartphone with a Wi-Fi hotspot, like literally bringing those to parents at their homes. But one problem that is really big is, you know, the economic concerns.
So a lot of the lowest numbers are at elementary schools. What's going on there?
Yeah, so it's harder for younger kids to get online without their parents' help. So if parents are working, or if even the parents are having a hard time themselves trying to figure out how to use the devices or the programs, maybe because there's a language barrier there, that's definitely part of it. Younger kids have less digital literacy. You know, they've had less time in class working on devices and fewer skills, whereas, you know, maybe students in middle or high school would be more easily able to get online, stay online. Obviously, also younger students, you know, it's hard to get them to sit still and look at the screen and be engaged for a longer period of time. Also, one thing that's affecting the numbers for elementary schools is pre-K. There's been really low participation in pre-K, which is a voluntary program. It's not required like kindergarten. And the elementary schools in the poorer areas where we've seen some of the lower attendance numbers are actually more likely to have pre-K programs because the pre-K program is subsidized by the federal government with Title I funding.
Schools with large populations of immigrant students also saw lower attendance rates. What can you tell us about that?
You know, we have a lot of migrant farm workers in South Dade, and their kids go to schools in those communities. So in those cases, you know, their parents are essential workers. They're in the fields harvesting food, and so they're not able to be home helping students get connected and staying online for their virtual school. And the language barrier, of course, is another factor. It can be more difficult for parents who don't speak English to help their kids use the devices and use the programs for the virtual education. Here's something Superintendent Alberto Carvalho shared about that.
I'll give you an example. West Homestead K-8, where you have a very large percentage of students who are Guatemalan, who are undocumented, and their parents are undocumented, who do not speak Spanish or English. They speak a variety of dialects, including Mam and Quechua, and that's where we're seeing a significant impact in terms of attendance.
Beyond the language, there's also fear. Several people I spoke to said that immigrant families are really afraid right now of ICE enforcement or deportation, and they don't feel as comfortable logging on to the virtual programming, maybe not as comfortable reaching out to the school district or receiving home visits. And by the way, Superintendent Alberto Carvalho has said the programs are totally secure and that they're not being accessed by any law enforcement entities.
So what is the Miami-Dade School District doing to try to get kids involved who aren't attending school right now?
So every day, principals are reviewing their rosters to see which kids aren't logging on, and they're doing a lot of things to try to communicate with families. They're writing letters, emails, texts, calling. They're also sending notes home in the bags of food that the district is handing out that remind parents students need to be logging on for school. And one of the things they're doing that's super targeted to students who haven't been connected is home visits, which of course is really tricky right now, given the risk of the coronavirus. But they have staff members, specifically community intervention specialists, who, you know, they wear masks and gloves, and sometimes they're escorted by police officers, and they go and knock on doors to try to talk to families about what barriers they're facing to get online or get connected and try to figure out how to fix them. But when they're doing those, Superintendent Carvalho says it's been something like detective work in some cases, because they might get to a house and find out that the family has moved or some families have doubled up, maybe because their economic situation has changed. And they've also found families' phones have been disconnected.
Okay, so for those students who are being marked present, just because they're logging on, that doesn't mean they're participating, right?
Right. So the district is taking attendance by counting whether students log onto the portal each day for class. So you could log on and not really do much else and still be considered present. Principals are monitoring more data. They have more information about what students are doing, their participation. But some teachers are telling me they have students who are logging on, but that they haven't been in touch with or gotten any work from. I talked to a teacher, Megan Gableman. She teaches third grade at Santa Clara Elementary School in Alapata. That first week, the week of April 6th, that school had around 80% attendance, but she said only about half of her students were in contact with her and actually doing work and learning. She did say, though, that she is seeing students make huge strides in short periods of time and seeing them and their families take more ownership over their learning.
For so long, I don't think kids or parents have had the opportunity to be a major driver of the learning process. So for me, when I see kids or parents like struggling, I don't get scared of it. I say, okay, bring me your anger, bring me your frustration. Let's go through it together. If we want parents to be involved and we want that gap to be bridged, then we have to lead them and welcome them when that frustration and pain comes.
So for example, Ms. Gableman says she has a student whose mom reached out to her saying she was really frustrated and overwhelmed and about to give up. She has multiple children at home and they were sharing a laptop. And so Ms. Gableman said, okay, meet me on Zoom. We'll have a Zoom call. We can see each other. We can share the computer screen so I can show you how to use it. And she was able to help that student figure out how to get through her day. So she's been having experiences like that day to day where she's able to connect to a family she hadn't heard from before. And once she can make that connection, then she can get them online to stay.
That was WLRN education reporter Jessica Bakeman. A reminder, schools throughout Florida will remain remote for the remainder of the school year. And you can find more of our reporting and resources by going to WLRN.org/coronavirus. Well, still to come, how are stay-at-home orders leading to a greater amount of cases of domestic violence? It's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, stay at home, social distance, stay 6 feet away. These guidelines are essential in flattening the curve of infections. But for some people, these guidelines mean being trapped in unhealthy and abusive circumstances. Early reports show a rise in domestic violence, and advocates want to remind people that help is still available. I'm joined now by Somi Ali, founder of the domestic violence and human trafficking nonprofit called No More Tears. It's based here in Miami. Somi, thank you so much for the time today.
Thank you for having me.
When the world started to go into lockdown, you know, there was a concern that it could be problematic for people who are living in abusive homes. As the order passed to stay at home, what were you afraid could happen?
I was afraid of more incidents taking place, and we were extremely, extremely concerned for victims being abused and not being able to reach out for help. And we kept putting on our social media that there is help available. Please reach out to us. We're still functioning, even though the shelters are unable to take in victims. We have other means of housing them. So we were really, really worried about the survivors in need.
So the preliminary reports show that domestic abuse has gone up. What have you seen happen this past
month? Well, prior to the virus, we were answering about 20 calls a day for help, and now we're answering about 50 calls a day.
What's the assistance that your organization provides?
So we've never had a shelter, but we have other means of safe houses. And so we have about 37 victims scattered all over Dayton, Broward, and Palm Beach in our safe housing. And we're providing them shelter, food, medical attention, and counseling through video sessions.
I wonder, do you think people might be hesitating to call because they might believe that things are all shut down and no one's going to be available? Are you worried that that may be happening?
Absolutely. And that's why I want people to know, if anyone is listening to this and they are in a situation, that please reach out to us. We are here to help. We're fully functioning.
I mean, what else are you doing to overcome that? What are you doing to make sure that the messaging remains steady?
Well, we cater to a very different demographic. In addition to Caucasian Americans and African Americans, we also cater to, with my background being Muslim, we cater to South Asians and Middle Eastern women. So we have literature. We're going around putting out literature in Indian, Pakistani grocery stores, as well as Arab grocery stores, Hispanic grocery stores, because in spite of the virus, the abusers are still making the victims go in and grocery shop. And believe it or not, we've had South Asian and Middle Eastern women call during the pandemic after they see our brochures in the grocery stores.
Tell me about some of the calls that you're getting. What have victims been telling you about what the situation is like now at home and living in this kind of, you know, we're all locked down. We all have to stay at home, which, again, could be worse for folks like that.
Absolutely. The first call that we received during the pandemic was of a victim that was able to walk to Walgreens and call us for help because she coughed and her husband beat her to the pulp and threw her out of the house, and because he assumed she had the virus. We're getting calls of victims that just are unable to reach out to their family members or connect with them. So they're able to flee at some point in the middle of the night, and they go to someone in the parking lot or somewhere that they can obtain a cell phone and call us. So we're getting all sorts of calls. We're getting referrals from nonprofits, from other victim advocates of police departments, since we work in Palm Beach, Dade, and Broward. Believe it or not, we flew in a victim from Texas that had nowhere to go because the shelters are not unable to take in victims. And we flew her in. She's a trafficking victim. She's 4 months pregnant and she's under our care now. So it's very broad in terms of who we're helping.
Have you noticed anything different about the abuse that's happening, again, because of the conditions that we're living in? Has something changed?
It's more brutal. It's more cruel. It's just so much more. There's such a huge spike in it, and the cruelty is just unfathomable. And it's really, really sad for victims that are in abusive situations. And this is unprecedented. We have never seen anything like this.
Right now, though, is there enough room at shelters? With all this, the opportunity to help. Is that there? Because, you know, we keep hearing about, how this pandemic is stressing the healthcare industry, but I'm wondering in this situation, what have you seen?
What I've seen is that a lot of the law enforcement agencies and other nonprofits and victim advocates are reaching out to No More Tears because, again, we've never had a shelter. We have other means of housing, and we have room available. So since shelters are not taking in people, justifiably so, their hands are tied because they don't want other people to get infected that are already in there. And also, they don't have any room available. We are filling that void, rather. So all the calls are coming to No More Tears because we do not have a shelter and we have other means of housing.
And how much opportunity is there for housing right now when it comes to trying to help victims of domestic violence? I mean, is there enough?
We have enough room for 500 victims at this point in time.
And what are you doing? Because, the challenge right now is, we have to protect ourselves in this pandemic, in those shelters, in those places. What's being done to make sure that you still have the ability to social distance, but also maybe even test or at least keep people quarantined from each other so that you don't have a situation like maybe in nursing homes where the COVID-19 is just spreading?
Absolutely. So they all have private spaces and they're not next to one another. They're far apart. And what we're doing is we're having groceries delivered directly to the door and the groceries are left outside. All the survivors that are under our care have masks and gloves. They do have access to medical attention if need be. They are provided video online therapy by our private therapists. They are provided medication. Many of them are suffering through mental ailments, and we are able to provide them medication through our psychiatrist. So we are offering, we're fully functional, except everything is done via phone, email, and video chat.
I'm talking with Somi Ali. She's the founder of the domestic violence human trafficking nonprofit No More Tears. The organization has been inundated with more calls since the coronavirus pandemic started. By the way, their crisis line is 954-324-7669. Again, that's 954-324-7669. We'll post that up on our social media as well. So, I mean, you're a survivor of domestic abuse, and this is part of why you're doing this work. But my understanding is this happened to you when you were still a teenager. What can you share about your experience and how it shaped you?
Well, my abuse started in Pakistan. It was with the house help. From the age of 5 to 9, I suffered sexual abuse with various house help that we had. And then at the age of 14, I was raped in Miami. When we moved to America, my mom, my brother, and I moved here when I was 12. And then I moved to India at 16, and I was in the film industry. And from 16 to 24, I was a victim of domestic violence at the hands of the guy that I was dating. So I know what it's like in many aspects, and I know what survivors go through. I know what victims of sexual abuse that are children go through, and I think it's very therapeutic for me to have had initiated this program, this organization. It's very healing for me, and it's very, very satiating in terms of my growth and my mental health.
What was the catalyst, though, for you in getting this advocacy work started and getting No More Tears off the ground?
So when I broke off my relationship in India and moved here from India in 2000, I had to start from scratch. I had dropped out in 9th grade, so I had to get my GED, get my bachelor's degree, and go to UM for my master's. And I knew I wanted to help children and women, and I thought the best way to heal was to initiate a 501c3 and to help victims that are brought from different countries. Having grown up in India and Pakistan, I've seen the worst in terms of treatment of women, children, and men. And I wanted to help women and men and children that are brought to this country and are abused. And that permeated into not just helping immigrants, but also working with Americans that are victims of human trafficking and domestic violence. And then it kind of became national for No More Tears because we're listed with the National Human Trafficking Hotline. I also wanted the model to be salary free, so no one takes a salary at No More Tears. 100% goes to the victim services programs. I have other means of income from my work in India. I bought property, so I live off of the rental income. So it's a very uniquely run charity where 100% does go to the victim services programs. We provide every service under the sun. And of course, the motivation was because of what I witnessed. I've seen acid burning in India and in Pakistan. I've seen brides being burned over dowry. I've seen my own mother being abused at the hands of my father. Of course, myself being abused as a child. And it's very sad because for some reason I thought that it was only in the Pakistani Indian culture that it was swept under the rug. But when I moved to America, I realized that no one wants to talk about it here either. And I decided to be the voice for that.
What do you say to people about how to speak up? How do you help people speak up? Because we know from talking to survivors for years and years that was always a challenge. How do you stand up to that abuse, but how do you also speak up and reach out for help? What does it take to finally get someone to get that courage to do that?
It takes a long time, but fortunately enough, we have such an amazing team of therapists. And we also offer training to survivors to be the voice of taking a stand against domestic violence or human trafficking. And we've been fortunate enough where we've had 6 to 10 survivors that have been the voice and they want to pursue social work. The first victim that we rescued had graduated with a PhD in pharmacy in 2011. Her husband beat her for 10 years because she wanted to go to school. And she got her PhD through our program. But therapy plays a pivotal role in their healing. I don't think one can fully heal. I know I'm not fully healed from what I endured. And I know that this trauma is very, very, very severe and it takes a lot. But we've had survivors that have become voices for us, have become ambassadors for No More Tears. And they want to keep speaking at events. They want to go to high schools and talk to students because talking about teenage domestic violence and dating violence. And, you know, a lot of children are recruited online. So all these survivors that have been under our care, we train them to become speakers. And it's amazing what one can accomplish if you give them guidance and love.
And, you know, the other thing right now, too, is the fact that because we have to stay distant from each other, that therapy right now, is that happening online?
Yes, it is. So we were fortunate enough. There's a gentleman, Gary Thompson, who has been provided us over 17 laptops for all the survivors that are in our safe houses. And so our therapists are able to do video sessions with them.
Again, we've been talking with Somi Ali, the founder of the domestic violence human trafficking nonprofit, No More Tears. And again, as we've said, that we've seen the reports that domestic violence calls are coming in now at much greater numbers than much greater rate than before. Again, living in this world of staying at home and self-quarantining is problematic for some people. Again, the crisis line for No More Tears is 954-324-7669. That's 954-324-7669. We will share that on our social media. Somi, thank you so much for sharing your story and sharing the information with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Again, 954-324-7669. So when should we reopen things like on Miami Beach? Mayor Dan Gelber is going to be joining us soon to answer those questions. But first, we're going to meet world traveler Wilkin Brutus, our new Palm Beach County reporter. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Wilkin Brutus is back home in Palm Beach County. He spent the past couple of decades traveling, going to Europe, teaching English in South Korea, and he worked as recently in Philadelphia with a new media startup. After 2 years with the Palm Beach Post, he's joined WLRN as our new Palm Beach County reporter. Now, I spoke with Wilkin last week about his passion for travel, storytelling, and understanding diverse cultures through lived experiences. one that really jumped at me was when you were talking about how you self-identify, how we identify as people. But because you were born in Miami from Haitian immigrants, but people have thought of you as African American. And you were debating this issue of how exactly you identify. And I wanted to know, how do you identify?
Yeah, well, for second generation Americans, particularly Haitian Americans, identity is actually fluid. I tend to identify as Haitian American because I'm literally sandwiched between cultures and value systems. But I also identify as Black or African American because I'm essentially a byproduct of my lived experiences. You know, how I look, how the world perceives me. There is this Toni Morrison, who she once wrote, "Definition belongs to the definers, not the defined." So even though I may identify myself as Haitian American, I place more emphasis on my lived experiences.
You've gone to different parts of the world, and I wondered what they've said about how they look at you and how that relates to what you see in yourself.
Yeah, sure. I've been to Europe. When I was 18, I actually traveled to England during the Queen Jubilee, and that was also during the World Cup. And so I've always been quite fascinated by in-group and out-group dynamics. And so by the time I moved to Jeju Island, South Korea, I knew I'd interact with people who may have never met or touched a dark-skinned, melanated American, to say the least. And so human beings will always other each other. And I think the goal is to make positive learning experiences out of it. And I felt that sharing these stories were necessary for people who were interested.
That, and I'm glad you brought that up, because I mean, there's a video of that too. When you were in this city, this town, there was a woman who came up to you and started touching your hair.
Oh my God. I did not give her permission. Here you go.
It was so uncomfortable to watch, and yet how it all played out. I'm wondering, how did you feel, as people are looking at you and maybe they had never seen a dark-skinned person before? Were you uncomfortable or threatened?
I was definitely interested as well. I think when people other another human being, they don't realize that their reaction is also reciprocal. That video was viral on Facebook. I think it sits around 6 million views, and majority of the comments were quite surprised by my positive reaction to that woman. And she was an old woman. Grandmothers get a lot more leeway. babies and grandmothers, right? Babies and grandmothers can do anything. And so you can clearly sense that she had no malintent, that she wasn't trying to pet me as some sort of pet, that there was this sort of urge, this human urge to just be near me, just to be close to me. And I think any human being would want to experience that, especially if they're living in South Korea.
You spent 4 years in South Korea. How did you end up there?
Yeah, so I was a certified English teacher in Jeju Island and Busan. In 2009, I spent months researching how to teach abroad. And by early 2010, I took an informed risk in the Korean education system. And I went there with no friends or contacts. And that's how it happened, off the limb.
You know, those experiences like that, I wonder, you think about, growing up in South Florida, and it's a very diverse area. But how then you go to another country all the way around the world, how your time there shaped your perception of diversity and, again, of self-identity, considering how different a place it was.
Sure. I've always had the travel bug and this sort of undying quest to understand different cultures, the human condition, to challenge my system of reality. And I left a few weeks after the devastating earthquake in Haiti. And I was actually still trying to hear word from cousins who were displaced from that earthquake. So I left with a heavy heart. But as the only Haitian American on that island, I found myself serving as this sort of unofficial ambassador for all things Haitian and Black American. It was quite the experience.
Going through some of the other videos, another one that I found so fascinating was, talking about trying to understand how a generation has grown and represented itself through social media. First of all, you're talking about millennials, right?
Yeah, so you know, I was born in 1983, so I consider myself the elder statesman of millennials, right?
Okay, yeah, that.
And millennials have this this do-it-yourself spirit through tech. Early blogging days, MySpace, Tumblr, YouTube tutorials and commentary, startups, the rise of coding camps. You know, we cultivate ideas through better software and community building tools. But I do fear the echo chambers we've built because everyone is suffering from information overload, and I think that crosses generations. But to some extent, millennials have been ready for this because we've always navigated this sort of fragmented world.
But I'm wondering in your travels, in your journeys, and understanding how millennials have been shaped by technology, what else do you see in the other generations and how technology is shaping us?
For example, my parents are avid WhatsApp users. And and that's good and bad. I'll start with the bad. Bad is because they can't really differentiate between real and fake news. And so you do find yourself sort of babying, for lack of a better term, your parents in certain tech spaces. But they're doing quite well. They're doing online banking. That's just a way of society as a whole. It's all about whether older Gen Xers can create a career out of technology. And I think that's what differentiates between the generations. We are more prone to create a career out of it, whereas older generations may use it as a utility.
We're talking with Wilkin Brutus. He is the new Palm Beach County reporter for WLRN. Some of you recognize him. He worked for the Palm Beach Post. Also, he's a YouTube host, and you can check out some of his videos on our social media, WLRN Sundial. You're a storyteller by nature. I mean, just everything that I've seen of what you've done, it's in your DNA. How did you end up in journalism?
I graduated from FAU with a major in multimedia studies. So my main goal was always a career in media, and my popular YouTube channel, which documented my experiences abroad, sort of afforded me that opportunity. So when I got recruited to help a now defunct media startup in Philadelphia, which had a partnership with Ebony Magazine, we had worked with WHYY, Philly's NPR station, Philadelphia Inquirer. But when Samantha Ragland, who is currently a faculty member at the Poynter Institute, hired me at the Palm Beach Post, that's when my journalism career really took off by, working alongside veteran journalists.
Yeah, and you think about all your travels, you're back in South Florida. So it wasn't really intentional, or is it just how life played out for you?
Yeah, it's certainly how life played out for me. I moved back to South Florida. It's home. I was born in Miami, raised in Palm Beach County. And when I came back home, my ultimate goal was to apply to the Palm Beach Post. So it was actually a dream come true, in a sense.
One of the interesting things about Palm Beach County, I always think about is how fast that place has changed.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's hard to ignore Palm Beach County's entrepreneurial spirit, the rising tech hub, the diverse art and food scene. We see ourselves catching up to the quality scenes in Miami and Fort Lauderdale. Changes have happened and they continue to happen.
You know, one of the other things, though, too, and I remember seeing this is you look at West Palm Beach, for example, but this is happening in a number of different communities where all of a sudden development comes in and massive development. You know, you think about that downtown West Palm Beach area, and they have I believe it's called City Place, City Center, City Place.
City Place.
Yeah, and I mean that
Well, it's
really.
called Rosemary Square now.
Yeah. And you know, I mean, what people may not realize or people may not remember is so much of that area was a community. And it tended to be it was the black community mostly. And then they came in and just built. And it's just part of the gentrification story, right? And it's in so many places. You've seen this happen over the years. What's going on, in that development? What's happening to those communities? Where are they getting pushed to?
Yeah, I think gentrification is a nationwide story that has the same sort of themes attached to it, where people from said community would tend to ask, where was the city and local governments and state governments? Where were they when we were asking for dollars, for capital to invest in these communities? And so we've had broken window policies, all of these, different types of punitive policies for these type of communities, but no real investment to help build these communities. And so when gentrification come, Obviously, there are some, I guess, quote unquote, positive sides of gentrification, where obviously you see more capital, but it comes at the expense of the culture, at the expense of people who occupy those spaces first, and they sort of get priced out and pushed out without no real investment in those individuals, in those families. And so that's a story that is nationwide, and Palm Beach County is no different.
What are the things that, you know, for you are most important that as a reporter now for WLRN, you know, you want to make sure there's a voice for, you know, coming out of that community?
Sure. You know, as the Palm Beach County reporter, it's my job to highlight the inner workings of this massive county. And it is massive. And to showcase the nuances in all of the cities that have their own unique character. Lake Worth Beach, for example, is very different from West Palm Beach. But yet we're working on one common goal, and that is to advance the communities we belong to. And so my job ultimately is to, again, highlight what makes each city different and all of the inner workings of our county as a whole.
Any stories you're working on right now? I know you just started, but you're ready to jump right in. So what kind of stories are you working on right now?
Yeah, so a story I'm working on now is the record-breaking uptick in pet adoptions Palm Beach County just received. Obviously, because of the COVID-19 pandemic, people are searching for companionships. And so I'm working on that story. I'm also working on a Haitian translation story, making sure that the Haitian community is receiving essential services by making sure that they're receiving documents that are adequately translated. So there are definitely a number of stories that I'm working on right now.
That is WLRN's Palm Beach County reporter Wilkin Brutus. If you live in Palm Beach County, you got some story ideas for him, you can email him wbrutus@wlrnnews.org. You can find him on Twitter at Wilkin, that's WILKINE, Brutus. So I took a drive around Miami yesterday to see what was happening, and I made it out to Miami Beach, and I got to tell you, it is surreal. I mean, there are people out, right? Not many, but some running, biking, some walking their dogs along the pathways next to the beach. Of course, the beaches are still closed, as are most of the businesses along Ocean Drive. Again, surreal. I thought I was in a movie. So what is it going to take to reopen some of that? And how can we do it and stay safe? We're joined now by Miami Beach Mayor Dan Gelber. Mayor Gelber, always a pleasure.
How you doing? Not easy questions.
Not easy questions at all. I'm doing okay. I hope you're doing well and staying safe. But look, you're in talks with South Florida leaders to start reopening the economy. And the first part of this process that was discussed was reopening parks and beaches. First of all, how did the conversation start? I mean, was it Miami-Dade Mayor Carlos Jimenez who got all this started? How did it get going?
Well, the county, I mean, you know, here's how it works. And people sort of wonder. The way it works is the county makes its decisions, and that's sort of we can't go more loose than the county, but we certainly can be more stringent. So to a certain extent, we follow, but we don't duplicate. Does that make sense to you?
Yes.
And so the county mayor, some of these things we put in our emergency order, some he did, some we embraced that he had done. He's indicated that he's ready to, I think, revisit three areas that, in my judgment, we could revisit. Opening up parks to some passive activity in a way that, you know, our residents could easily avail themselves of without violating social distance concepts. So think about, you know, not having tot lots or gym equipment available, basketball courts closed, things that are impossible to exercise social distance. So we, I think, sort of agree with that. The next thing would be marinas and golf courses, and I think the same could be said for those. And I think if we sort of think of those places as open spaces that they give us the ability to, you know, do things without really violating what has, I think, helped us immensely right now.
The idea is people could still be 6 feet or more apart from each other.
Yeah, I mean, as you know, if you're not playing basketball and you're not in an organized football game, and you're not on, your kids aren't on a tot lot with 40 other kids, and you're not in gym equipment that somebody just talked to, was just on, you can probably do pretty well. And And honestly, giving people are getting nuts. So giving them some more open space to have access to would be healthy, frankly.
And the third one I'd imagine, right, is beaches.
Well, it's the three are actually parks, marinas, and golf courses. The fourth are beaches, and that's an entirely different story.
Before we get into that, I wanted to ask, it's not just the county and the different municipalities, right? Isn't it also other South Florida leaders from Palm Beach County all the way down to the Keys? Is it everybody talking to each other?
Well, there's a lot of talking. I talk to the mayor of Fort Lauderdale regularly, Mayor Chantalis, because we share a sort of a similarity in a sense that we know, we have really open beaches. And people may not think about this a lot, but if you go to the Miami Beach, 7.5 miles of beaches, while there are condos there, obviously, I mean, from 1st to 15th Street, it's mostly open. Hallover is obviously, not Hallover, the 80th Street area is totally open. And in between are lots of open areas and open stretches. So like Fort Lauderdale and that strip, if we opened up our beaches, we know what would happen, which is they would be converged upon because, heck, we have beautiful beaches. People would want to do that.
So that was part of the discussion, possibly. Again, just saying what was being discussed is the fourth option. Then, the state said, governor said, we could do this, right? We could do this if we practice social distancing. Then we saw Jacksonville do this, and then all of a sudden there was the image and the hashtag that went national when we saw thousands of people hanging on the beach. Did that basically change everybody's mind here? Like, nope, can't open the beach now.
I've never had a mind that needed to be changed. I've never believed. I know my city. I was born here. I've watched Memorial Day. I've watched spring break. We have the most beautiful beaches in the world on some of the most beautiful strips in the world. If we open up our beaches, tens of thousands of people will come here immediately. The idea, because one thing people don't understand is I get every day dozens of emails saying, let's just open it up for residents. And I have to tell them, you cannot do that. It's not legal. So we can't just say this is just for Miami Beach residents. It's a public beach. It's a state beach. It's not even literally our property. So, we would have to open it up for everybody. And if we open it up for everybody, we know what will happen. We've all seen that. Jacksonville's nothing like what you're going to see in Miami Beach or in probably Fort Lauderdale. All these young kids here on spring break. I have two kids home from college on permanent spring break and one 15-year-old on a permanent whatever it is in the Dade County schools. I'll have to lock them, home with padlocks just to keep them from going to a beach, which all their friends will go to. So we know what will happen. And I don't need Jacksonville to show me. We cannot open up our beaches right now when we're trying to practice social distancing.
So let's talk about the idea of reopening and what that means. Because, look, we hear it from the White House all the way down. People are asking, how do we, get back to some kind of normalcy? What does that look like for you? What do you think?
Well, I think for us, it's different than other places. My city, like any destination city, is built on the idea of bringing large groups of people here for gatherings, for everything but social distancing. We have beautiful restaurants and clubs, amazing hotels and beaches, obviously, promenades like Lincoln Road and Ocean Drive, which when we're on a typical moment, expect to be crowded, where everybody's happy and seeing one another, almost, at a level where they're on top of each other. Well, obviously, we can't do that right now. So our business model is really pretty incompatible with what they're telling us to do, which is social distancing. So for us, we're a little late to the game in a sense that I don't know how we're going to be able to open up until we're pretty certain that it's going to be that we're going to be able to moderate and minimize the risk. And of course, one of the biggest problems here is that if you read Reopening America from the White House, it says there's got to be all this surveillance going on and contact tracing and, all the different things in testing and greater capacities than we have. So the first problem is all the things that we're supposed to do to phase in, restaurants and venues and things like that. I don't know that we have that capacity or we will have it. But putting that aside for a moment, at the end of the day, the worst thing that would happen to our community is if we rushed into a reopening and had a major relapse, because that's a big problem. So for me, what we're doing is our city is on the three things we spoke about, those are that's sort of low-hanging fruit. It's not going to be hard to do parks, golf courses, and yeah. marinas.
Yeah.
But when you get to beaches, I think it's a non-starter for a while. And when it gets to some of this other stuff, we might be able to open some stuff up when our medical professionals and scientists say we've diminished the spread of this in the community so much
yeah.
that it's safe to with good social distancing. Until that moment, we shouldn't do anything.
I'm talking with Miami Beach Mayor Dan Gelber, again, Miami-Dade County, starting conversations about reopening things. But what will that look like? We're going to hear from Miami-Dade Mayor Carlos Jimenez later this week. You can find more of our coverage, by the way, on all of this at WLRN.org/coronavirus. I wanted to ask you, Mayor, about this. Governor DeSantis this weekend finally releasing the names of nursing homes where we see cases. North Beach Rehabilitation Center is one of the 54 in Miami-Dade County with cases. How are you working with nursing homes right now to support, again, some of the most vulnerable individuals we have in our community?
Well, I've always described it this way. I think in the general population, we do risk management. But among our senior population, we do risk elimination. So at the very beginning, we didn't wait for people to tell us best practices. We went to the couple dozen places that are senior centers and homes where they predominantly live under some kind of housing we know about. And we immediately, you know, sort of started doing things like making sure best practices were going on. We reached out to the different owners because they're owned by different groups. Some are private, some are county, some come from other places. So we immediately started best practices. We're doing testing right now with anyone in the senior community who calls. We'll go to their place and take care of it. We have a testing center that'll do that for our seniors at home testing. We are limiting their, you know, public transportation. We stopped our trolleys because we thought the trolleys were really a terrible way for which seniors love them, and they're free, and we fix the seats every year so they're softer. I mean, we really go overboard to make sure that they have really easy transportation. But of course, in a pandemic, when you're sharing a trolley that has 500,000 people on it in the course of a month, that's how many we're taking our free trolleys typically, and they're mostly seniors and people visiting, two worst groups to have in the same trolley yeah. car.
And Mayor, I'm curious, when you saw the list, when you saw what the governor had released, you know, I'd wondered if any of it had surprised you.
Well, listen, I was only surprised the list wasn't available earlier because I didn't quite understand why. I mean, there has been a little bit of we have not gotten a lot of information about what trend lines are happening from the Department of Health. It hasn't been, you know, if they're doing contact tracing, they haven't really let us know that there's a trend we should be concerned about or things like that. It just hasn't happened. So it's a little disconcerting because, like most cities our size, we don't have a health department that has capacity to do the kind of science and medicine you need. We don't really have a health department. So, and the county health department is really part of the state's health department. So they don't even work for the county mayor. They work from the surgeon general and from the secretary.
Yeah.
So there's, you know, there's sort of that disconnect. And I think, look, what's obviously happening is when you have something like this, it reveals all the fault lines that exist in the system that's being challenged, in this case, the healthcare system. We got into our countermeasures that we were too little too late. And my city was the first to do almost everything. First to shelter in place in Florida, the first to start closing everything down, and one of the first in the nation to require masks. But we still did too little too late. Because the messaging coming out was, well, in early March, there really weren't any cases. So until you have community spread, you don't have to do anything. Well, how would you know if you had community spread if you don't have any testing to tell you you have community spread? It was really sort of absurd. And now the rush is to do too much too soon. And that would be the same mistake that happened in the front end of this. This is a deadly virus. It's got a disastrous economic repercussion that has to be respected and addressed, but you can't rush into something knowing that it could impact hundreds or thousands of lives. And I will say this, 209 people have died in Dade County. because of this virus, and there's 160 something or something like that on ventilators right now, and most of them may die. So this is going to really cause hundreds of people in our county to perish. Imagine had we not done any of the social distancing.
Yeah.
It would be thousands.
I want to just, as we wrap up here, you know, come back to listening to you early on. I mean, look, the focus is right now dealing with the pandemic and protecting lives. But at the same time, you're running a city. And, you know, that city is losing a lot of money and it's hurting a lot of people. Eventually, you know, we're going to get everything reopened. We just don't know when and how. But what do you think this is going to do to Miami Beach? How do you think the city's going to get through this?
The city's going to get through this. We got through Andrew, and we got through Zika. We got through recession. We've got through quite a bit. And
this is worse, though.
It's worse, but listen, we're going to get through this because, first of all, the structural beauty of our city and the spirit of our city will remain intact. Right? We still will have a wonderful place with a population that is here for a reason. There's a lot of pain right now, lots of pain, and both health-related and economic-related, obviously. But that at some point, that we're going to emerge. It's going to be in our rearview mirror, and we will, you know, sort of we will rebuild back that economic structure, and we will make sure that we have put in place the kinds of things we need to better withstand the healthcare challenges, because this may become something that happens more regularly than we are accustomed to. And guess what? We know how to deal with hurricanes. We snap into position. We know what to do in our homes, what not to do. And we will learn how to deal with this also. And it may be a little bit more inconvenient, but that's how we operate, and that's what we do, and we'll do it again. And we're still going to be the most beautiful city I could imagine, and one that people are going to flock to in the millions.
Miami Beach Mayor Dan Gelber, always a pleasure. Thank you for the
time.
Thank
you. Thank you. Bye-bye.
And again, just a reminder, we will be talking with Miami-Dade County Mayor Carlos Jimenez on Wednesday. That's our program for this Monday, April 20th. Remember, find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Go to WLRN.org/coronavirus for all your coronavirus coverage. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Stay safe. We'll talk to you tomorrow.